Scott?
May it please the court, Ted Scott for petitioner Veritas Chino Valley Medical Center. With me also today is the hospital's associate general counsel, Mary Schottmiller. I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. The first point I'd like to make to the court, actually, it's more in the nature of a confession. In the unions,
no, we don't usually take those here. Go down to the district court.
I better get an attorney to counsel me before I do this, I guess. But in our opening brief at page 10 and page 46, we referenced some conduct by Sharon Lemoyne. The union pointed out in their opposition brief that there's no evidence that Ms. Lemoyne was a charge nurse. In preparing yesterday, I went back and looked through the record, and the union is absolutely correct in that regard. I apologize for having that statement in our opening brief. It was a carryover from a statement we had made in our brief before the board. I take full responsibility.
Well, we appreciate that. We don't get apologies very often here, so we like to hear them.
I wanted you to know that. Otherwise, I know that the court has reviewed the briefing. I typically believe that my best arguments are in my brief rather than orally, and I certainly entertain any questions the court has, or I can go in and reemphasize some points from the brief.
Go ahead.
I have a question about your evidentiary claim. What is it? I'm not sure whether you're objecting to a ruling about admissibility, or whether you're objecting to a ruling about discovery.
It is not about the admissibility. It is about being precluded by the administrative law judge from seeking evidence with respect to the identification of employees who signed cards and may have been involved in as being targeted by charge nurses. What happened is we issued a subpoena seeking documents that would indicate evidence relating to coercion or pro-union conduct by the supervisors, the charge nurses,
and during the hearing on that, over the union's objection, the administrative law judge looked to me like she upheld most of the subpoena. For example, you asked for all communications between the union and the charge nurses, emails, documents, letters, text messages, and she permitted you to get that.
She did, but she allowed the union to redact all identifying information with respect to the employees who were involved in those communications for the most part, and we were also precluded.
In her ruling on the top of page 21 of the transcript, there's no qualification on that. She just said, I deny the petition to revoke paragraph 4 of the subpoena.
Just as to that particular paragraph. But
right, well, that's all communications between the charge nurses and the union. So is it just the name? You wanted the names of the people that were eligible to vote in the election to the extent that they showed up in any other communications?
Well, when we talk about communications, I think that our objection is broader than that. In the record, there are a number of organizing records that were kept by the union's lead organizer. There's a separate page or pages for each of the charge nurses, and we were permitted to receive those. However, all identifying information with respect to employees who were at meetings or who had been contacted by the charge nurses were redacted from those records.
See, one of the problems is that, if not the problem, is that there's no way that anyone in our position can tell whether that amounted to a hill of beans or not, and whether it would have changed the outcome of the proceedings before the ALJ or the board. We're talking about discovery, not admissibility, so you've made no proffer about what this evidence had you received those names, how that would have affected your presentation to the extent that it would have made a difference in the outcome.
Well, we would have then been able to call those employees and ask them questions with respect to the circumstances under which they signed the cards. Were there any charge nurses present? Did any charge nurses talk to them or encourage them to sign the authorization cards? Those are the types of things we would have been able to follow up on. As I am sure the court is aware, there is no discovery in these proceedings. So we are placed in a situation where we show up at the hearing, we are entitled to subpoena some documents, and then based on what the information is in those documents, we can proceed and present evidence.
Are the documents in response to your subpoena, are they typically turned over right at the hearing, or are they turned over ahead of time?
At the morning of the hearing, that's typically the first thing that's dealt with at the hearing.
And then you have an opportunity to ask for an adjournment in light of the presentation of materials, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Is that the way it usually goes?
Well, different judges handle it differently. Typically, they give you 5 minutes and say, let's proceed, and you can look at them at lunch or if we're having a two-day
hearing. How long was the proceeding here? How many days?
I believe we went, it was either 3 or 4 days. 4 days? Thank you, Ms. Shee. Yes. The ALJ's ruling in this regard was not only applicable to the documents, but we were also foreclosed from asking witnesses questions with respect to which employees were at the meetings where the charge nurses were also present, where the cards were.
I must say that the footnote in her opinion is baffling to me, because on the one hand, during the objections to the subpoena, she said, yeah, you can get all the communications between the charge nurses and the union. That's fine. You know, not a problem. And then she drops that footnote saying you can't introduce any evidence about it.
She found that evidence of the communications between the union and the charge nurses was not relevant.
Did you seek to introduce such evidence?
Oh, absolutely. And it went with
what
our...
What exactly did it consist of? And that's, again, it's hard for us to evaluate, or hard for me anyway, to speak for myself, to evaluate the prejudice without knowing what it was that she excluded.
Well, she essentially, with respect to the communications between the union and the charge nurses, some of that was allowed and was introduced into evidence, but essentially what the ALJ said was that that evidence was not relevant to our objections. However, our theory and our argument presented to the ALJ was that the manner in which the union targeted the charge nurses, acknowledged supervisors to lead the union's organizing campaign, that was stated in our objections.
Give me one example of evidence that the ALJ refused to consider that you think prejudiced your case. Not a generality, but give me one document, one communication between the union and the charge nurse.
Well, I would... I can grab the appendix if you'd like.
Sure.
Okay. I think the best example of this are the union organizing documents, beginning with at the appendix at A570 and continuing on through.
What volume is it?
I'm sorry?
570?
Yeah. Correct. That's in volume 2, I believe. So as you take a, and it continues, you know, these are the computer-generated notes from the union organizer. There are also handwritten notes from the union organizer that began at page 614 of the appendix. And you will see, I mean, you can't really tell because the information's just missing, but all of the information relating to the employees who were referenced in these documents were redacted.
That's it. Seems to me a different question than Judge Randolph was asking. He was asking about evidence that you weren't able to put into evidence. And is there some that you don't have? I didn't understand your brief as even arguing as objecting to the evidence issue, but only to the discovery issue. Am I wrong? Are you arguing?
That's correct. We were.
You're only asking about
admissibility, discovery.
My understanding of
that
your.
That was my understanding as well.
Your reply brief says at page 22, the employer does not disagree that communications between charge nurses and the union standing alone do not establish unlawful interference, and then goes on to say that you hope to get other evidence from that, but not that that evidence itself was relevant. And you say the same thing during the hearing at appendix page 28 when Judge Parker says, I'm not sure how that would be relevant in any way. Isn't it only when the supervisory charge nurse then does something vis-a-vis the non-supervisory employee? And you say, correct, that's the next step. I would agree with that, Your Honor. But these documents are relevant to getting us to evidence with respect to the charge nurse's activities.
Correct. And at that point,
so just to be clear, then, you're not objecting to preclusion of evidence about the relationship or context between the charge nurses and the union in terms of it admitting being admitted into evidence itself. You're only objecting to the question of not being able to get that from a discovery point of view.
Can I just follow
up? Well, that's one second. That's correct. And we are also objecting to the extent that none of that evidence was taken into account in evaluating our objections relating to the union targeting of the charge nurses.
I hear you saying that, but I don't read that either in the brief, and I certainly don't read that in your argument to Judge Parker. I don't read you as saying that there that this evidence was itself relevant to the question, that its communications evidence was relevant to the question of whether the election was lawful or not.
Well, the content of those I would agree, and that was the position we took. Perhaps I'm not understanding, and I apologize for that. Our objection goes to the failure to consider that evidence as it relates to the objections involving the union's deliberate targeting of the charge nurses to lead their organizing drive.
Is there any case about targeting? Any NLRB prior NLRB opinion which suggests that targeting is sufficient or necessary or relevant to the question of whether the election is valid or not?
No, there are no cases either way on that point. But I would note that in the Harborside case, there is a discussion with respect to the potential chilling effect of the ruling there relating to the solicitation of authorization cards by supervisors, and the dissent argues that this will chill a union from utilizing people who are on the borderline between being supervisors and not being supervisors in their organizing campaign, and the board in Harborside says, so be it.
Yeah, and it doesn't say that's itself a violation of the National Labor Relations
Correct.
Act, and it doesn't say that's enough to void an election. It just says tough luck.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay,
go ahead.
May I go back to the documents that you referred me to when I asked you the question, what are we talking about? Each one of those is marked ER 21, ER 22. I take it that's the exhibit number.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. Those were.
Does that mean it was in fact introduced? Each one of these documents was introduced into evidence?
Yes, they were.
So the judge didn't exclude any of this?
The judge did not exclude these documents, but she required information to be redacted from the documents.
The documents were introduced in this form, correct?
Correct.
What information was redacted?
Well, I just happen to have page 711 in front of me.
And you, page what?
711, A0711 in the appendix.
Seven. Oh, you're talking about the, tell me what it says.
Sure, but in there you can see, for example, in the first line, the name is redacted. There was a name, talk to Chris, and reports that she is still anti. That name was redacted. In the second line, there's a redaction, reports that Chris is against the union. These are the types of information that the ALJ would not allow us to obtain in order to then follow up with those individuals as potential witnesses in the proceeding.
You could, did the charge nurses testify?
Yes, they did.
And you could ask them which employees they corresponded with?
Correct. We could, and we got from a number of the charge nurses very vague answers, or I don't recall. We note in our brief the specific testimony from Charge Nurse Ely, in which she basically is very evasive on those issues, and then by not having the information in these documents that we did receive with respect to which employees were present when the cards were being signed, we were unable to follow up or call those individuals as witnesses.
The cards themselves were introduced?
No. We received the cards signed by the charge nurses, but no other cards.
Was that surprising? I mean, in National Telephone, the National Labor Relations Board says it would be chilling to unionization if the employer could find out the names of the people who signed the cards. You can understand how that would be the case, can't you? That if employees thought that if they signed cards or they expressed pro-union statements in secret, in private, and the employer were to find out about it, that there could be retribution for that, and that might dissuade them from affiliating with the union.
In particular circumstances, that's true, but National Telephone's facts are a lot different than our facts here, where we have a situation where supervisors were organizing on behalf of the union.
Well, if it's true in certain situations, then it's really just a typical abuse of discretion issue with respect to the admission of evidence, which we then review only for arbitrary and capriciousness. So let me just see if I can state the standard of review here. It would be, was the NLRB arbitrary and capricious in finding that the ALJ did not abuse her discretion in excluding and redacting the names? Is that's our standard of review?
Well, I think it is, but I would have a caveat that there is a balancing that is required there, but there's no place in the record where the ALJ or the board articulated the balancing or what the different factors were that she was going to balance to come to the conclusion she did. Instead, all we have is a conclusion.
If you have a situation, it's been a while, but is Gissel Packing still good law?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. If you had a situation involving authorization cards such as the Gissel type thing, a good faith employer doubt, the cards are the focus of the entire proceeding, aren't they? I mean, to determine whether they've been forged or whether they're genuine or what?
That's correct, Your Honor, and the board has no hesitancy when it serves the board's interest to use cards that have been signed by employees as evidence in a Gissel case.
That's the entirety of the case in a Gissel situation.
Certainly it is to show majority status. The board is required to introduce those cards into evidence.
On the merits of your claim, it seems to me that things change after March 5th, 2010. In other words, these charge nurses who were supervisors or were deemed to be supervisors engaged in a lot of activity before March 5th, 2010 that you think is problematic. But then Gilliatt and Silva, for example, renounced their prior positions and repudiated and come to speak out against unionization. So wouldn't an RN who was fearful of, say, Gilliatt and Silva after March 5th, 2010, actually have voted against unionization?
Well, I would say that is not so as reflected in the actual vote in the election. I'd also note that it's in
right. So maybe the coercion didn't work, but the point is that if you were fearful of those two people, presumably, unless you assume it's all wink and nod, but they changed their position pretty dramatically. Obviously, they're getting promotions and all that, and they're told by the employer. I understand why, but their position changes dramatically, and I wonder how we can rely on what happened before March 5th, 2010, given the substantial change in their position.
Well, I think that the board in every other case that we cite as it relates to the issue of the employer's anti-union campaign being a mitigating factor concluded that it did not.
I didn't see in those cases, like Madison Square Garden, SNE, and some of those cases, I didn't see where the supervisors had repudiated any prior statements, pro-union statements they had made in the same way that we have in the record in this case.
Well, I would agree with that, Your Honor, but when you look at those cases, you will see that the board draws distinctions with respect to whether there is evidence that something was actually communicated to the employee and demands pretty specific evidence in that regard. Additionally, those cases,
there's a letter that's signed by Gilliatt and Silva, at least, not all the charge nurses, but two,
right.
And they were two of the big ones, right? Especially
correct.
Gilliatt.
Correct.
And so she then signs a letter that is opposed to the union, right?
That's correct. She's opposed to the union, but she does not disavow in that letter her activities in encouraging employees to sign authorization cards. She does not disavow her conduct in attending meetings at which the cards were signed. She does say...
Don't you think signing a letter is de facto disavowal of your prior position?
I think when you take a look at the other board cases, you will see that they require disavowal of the specific conduct at issue.
What's the best case you have for that?
SNE, as well as Madison Square Garden.
Okay. I'm not sure I saw that, but I'll look at them again.
On page, before you sit down, on page 55 of your brief and elsewhere, but do you have that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right before the right before, in introducing the block quotation from the ALJ's opinion, it said she did refine her rationale for not allowing the employer to obtain evidence or present evidence relating to communications between the charge nurses and the union. Now, we've gone over that. She did allow you to obtain that. That's, she allowed paragraph 4 of the subpoena. What do you mean by saying for not allowing the employer to obtain that evidence?
Well, then she I believe, and I'd have to take a look at the record, Your Honor, but more closely, and I apologize for not.
And then we've also gone through these exhibits that you mentioned, and they were introduced. So that's the present.
But there were other, there were the redactions to the doc. I'm sorry, Your Honor, if I'm just repeating myself and not getting to your question.
Okay. No more questions? Thank you very much. We'll hear from Ms. Sheehy, I think.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Barbara Sheehy for the National Labor Relations Board here, seeking full enforcement of the Board's order. It's unanimous order certifying the union as the exclusive representative of the registered nurses at the Chino facility in April 2010, where the employees voted 72-39 in favor of representation. I want to touch on a couple of things. I'm going to go first to the evidentiary issue, because I think there's some things that could be clarified there. The first thing I want to say is, if you look at appendix page 23 during during the hearing, the first day of the hearing, at the very beginning, where the parties are talking about the subpoena, it was our understanding, and this was confusion in our brief. Initially, when we wrote our response brief and obviously reply to their opening brief, the board thought that the employer was objecting to not having obtained the authorization cards of the employees. Having reviewing for oral argument now, it's now our understanding that if you look at page 23 and 24, that the employer was not seeking that information. Specifically, Mr. Scott says, we're at the very bottom of page 23, we're not seeking an authorization card that is signed by a bargaining unit employee that contains no notations relating to the stipulated supervisors. So the judge did not, it's our understanding now that as it relates to any information about the solicitation cards themselves, that those are not an issue. That at the hearing, the employer said, we're not interested in those, and they accepted the representation of union counsel that there were no notations on those authorization cards. So as far as we understand it, the authorization card issue is not an issue. Again, as to how we understood.
So were the authorization cards covered by any of the paragraphs of the subpoena?
I believe they were. I believe the subpoena, part of the issue with the subpoena was written very, very broadly to include almost anything.
The employer's attorney admitted, right? That was too broad.
Sure, but that doesn't change the fact that it's probably going to encompass almost anything. So surely everybody was reading it to say the employer is seeking authorization cards of the employees.
Yeah.
But then seems to have, or not even seems, did abandon that at the hearing. So what it really boils down to is the documents that were disclosed, that they were redacted. And then also, if you're reading through the transcript, there were certain times where the employer was asking charge nurses as to what their communications were with the union, and that line of questioning was foreclosed. But almost all of the document requests, with the caveat that certain names were redacted, almost all the document requests were turned over, as I think Judge Randolph recognized. There were certain documents, I think, that were turned over, but ultimately, and again, these are the ones at tabs, starting at tab 24, and going through to tab, it's in our footnote page 14, footnote 14 on page 41, notes that all of the documents between 570 and 86 of the 586 of the appendix, which correspond to tabs 24 and 39, that those documents were admitted, they were redacted, they were admitted into evidence, but they. I'm sorry, page 41, sir. 41, Your Honor. And there's a footnote 14. Where we identify the documents that were admitted into evidence, but the judge expressly says, and this is at appendix, this is at the hearing 236 to 38 and page 241, that she is not admitting the documents as business records. The employer is trying to lay a foundation to admit the documents as business records. And at no point Do they take, as far as we understand it, at no point to the ALJ, did they, in their exceptions to the ALJ, did they take issue with her ruling in that regard? There's nothing to the board saying these should have been admitted as full documents for the truth of the matter asserted. And there's nothing in this court, in any of their briefs. So those documents, while in the record, there's nothing in them that they can rely on in terms of the statements. But what they were allowed to do, as they acknowledged, those documents were the notes, the computerized notes of the lead union organizer. And they were, let me describe them just briefly so you don't have to look at the appendix. They were, there was one page for each charge nurse. The charge nurse was clearly identified at the top. And it indicated, according to the lead union organizer, the various and her dates. He records the dates that he spoke to people, the charge nurses, what they relayed to him, what conduct they told him he did, what his feelings were about their sentiment on are they pro-union or are they anti-union, sort of what's their sentiment. But any time there was a specific reference to a charge nurse, I'm sorry, to a registered nurse, that was redacted. So the employer had the information about, according to the union organizer, all of the conduct that was recorded up through, I don't remember all the dates, but I think some of the dates go as far as March 1st, 2010. All of the conduct as recorded by the union organizer, by specific charge nurse, what they did. They called 13 charge nurses at the hearing. So they had every opportunity to question those nurses on the basis of those documents, because they're still in evidence, they're still there, it's just they're not being admitted for the full reason the employer wanted. Could have asked the charge nurse, you know, on March 1, it says that you spoke to so-and-so. What did you say to that person? None of that happened. They weren't allowed to identify the unit employee, but they certainly could have questioned, what did you tell this person? I understand you spoke to a unit employee because that person's name is redacted. And there's no information at all that they tried that. The employer does rely a lot on this whole stonewalling theory, citing Eli specifically, that she was evasive. But we'd also point out that there were several supervisors or several of the charge nurses that were quite forthcoming. And they didn't say, I don't remember. And they didn't say, I have no idea if anybody was there. They were very specific on information that was admissible in terms of numbers of employees that were at unit meetings, whether unit employees were spoken to, what they said to those people. So really what we're talking about is they were not entitled to receive the names of the unit employees, and they were foreclosed from asking information that flowed one way. They were not entitled to ask, as the judge said, and she didn't abuse her discretion in finding that information that flowed from the charge nurse to the union, or I'm sorry, from the union to the charge nurse, encouraging them to do something, is not relevant. And she says this throughout the transcript, that it's not relevant because it requires a leap of faith that if I ask you to do something, if I encourage you to do something, if I urge you to do something, you will do it. And that is precisely what she said she will not do. They had to show that the charge nurses did it. And in that regard, they failed.
Well, they, as of March 5th, 2010, there's a ton of evidence of interference under the Harborside test, at least as I read the record. And so going to the merits.
Sure. Respectfully, I'd say there's evidence in the record of pro-union supervisory conduct. Well, I would take issue with the characterization of interference, because interference presupposes that it was objectionable conduct.
You don't think Gilead's conduct pre-March 5th, 2010 was met the Harborside standard? I thought you even conceded that.
Well, what we said was the board, so let me clarify, because I don't mean to overstate what I intended to say. I was taking issue with an abundance of evidence in the record that multiple charge nurses engaged in objectionable conduct. I think you're right in focusing directly in on what did Gilead do. She was clearly the leader. She was clearly the one who there was the most amount of evidence about her. And absolutely, she said things in January before the meetings at the Hampton Inn where they were signing the authorization cards. She said things at the hospital. She encouraged people to go. She said, we want 100%. Absolutely.
And this was all probably confusion that stemmed from the 2008 election, in the sense that in the 2008 stipulation of who were supervisors, Gilead and Silva and Eiley were not considered supervisors. So it was probably anticipated that they wouldn't be supervisors again this time around. So they engaged in all sorts of conduct. And then March 5th, 2010 comes and oops, got to correct what happened, right?
I don't know that the record supports that whether they knew they were supervisors. I'm not clear, in fact, Eli was definitely a charge nurse, as far as I understand it, in the 2008 election. She was involved in the 2008 election. She was written.
I don't think she was a supervisor.
No, sorry. She was not a supervisor. Right. So I could see there may have been confusion with Eli. I don't know that the record shows whether Juliet was employed as, I don't know what she was employed as. Well, she certainly was not a charge nurse. You're absolutely right. In the 2008 election.
In any event, I was just trying to understand more broadly how this happened. And it seemed to me that's, one of the explanations, but it's really
absolutely
neither
that's
here
entire,
nor
that's
there.
Entirely
there's
plausible.
There's a ton of conduct. What I'm, for me, is the key issue is how we are supposed to look at the repudiation.
Sure.
And how strong that has to be. We have it from Juliet and Silva. We don't have it from the other charge nurses, correct?
There's no evidence in the record, no, that any other charge nurse went to the extent or did anything, in fact, that that said, I don't support the union anymore. I'm not interested in it. The evidence is strictly related to Silva and Juliet. But what I would say, before I get to their specific repudiating conduct, as it relates to the other charge nurses, there's no evidence that they engaged in any activity that remotely rises to the level of solicitation. They attended meetings, right, which the board has said. So I think that's why you don't see a focus.
Right. So you, if I can state what I think your position is, you tell me where it's wrong. With some of the charge nurses, their conduct didn't rise to the level of Harborside problem. Right. With Juliet and Silva, even assuming it did, it's corrected or mitigated by their post-March 5th, 2010 conduct in favor of the employer.
Right. What with the? In fact, I think if I could
yes,
refine it just a little, please, bit, I believe the board focused on just Juliet. So the board board passed on the issue as it relates to Juliet only.
Yeah.
They passed on the first prong of Harborside. They passed on the issue of, are we going to call her conduct solicitation?
But even Silva, even if Silva's conduct had been a problem, she signed that same letter.
She did send the same letter. But if you focus more on what Juliet did, they both repudiated their conduct. They both did it orally and they both did it in writing. What Juliet did a little bit more, she testified at least that she went to 20 to 30 employees and told them, I've had a complete change of heart. I don't think the union can help us at all anymore. So she
I assume everyone, I mean, I, hard for me to suspend my common sense completely here. I assume everyone knew what was going on. In other words, Juliet's now has been deemed a supervisor. She's gotten a promotion of some kind, right, a new position.
She did have a new position as of about March 15th. Whether her coworkers probably knew that she was promoted to a management position.
Right.
But that's neither here nor there. The interest is in what's
well, the... Well, it's here when she says, I've had a change of heart, I assume people are, yes, you'll be fired, presumably, if you continue with your old position. So your change of heart is coerced. This doesn't hurt you, by the way.
I can understand that. I would say that there isn't any evidence in the record that anybody was confused, that maybe her sympathies still lied with the union.
The briefs portray this sudden change of heart as if it just happens, you know, from somehow studying the merits of the positions, which I think requires a suspension of disbelief that I'm not willing to go with.
Right, except that that's how Juliet did testify. She said that she looked at both sides, so people went with what she said. But no, I'm completely understand what
you're
saying.
I suppose the other possibility is that the employer committed an unfair labor practice or interfered with the election by coercing her into going and coercing all those other nurses and telling them not to join the union.
Okay, that's another plausible explanation.
That was the problem with the 2008 one, right?
The union lost the election in 2008, filed objections on the basis of coercive conduct.
Exactly, but that was Judge Garland.
Exactly, that was not litigated. I mean, it was litigated, and then it was pending, and then they, right, you know, settled the case and moved on.
Right, but
and
then your time is pretty much up. Do you want to close up here with something? You're more than up.
Can I say two things on some of the cases that they relied on in terms of the mitigation doctrine? Just very, very quickly. Chinese News, I want to say there, the opposing counsel said that none of the cases have been set aside on the basis of a mitigating effect. Chinese News, the board says in that case there was no evidence of mitigation. In Madison Square Garden, I would encourage the court to have a look at what the employer did in that case and see how anemic and meager that effect was or that effort was in relation to what the employer did here. For instance, in that case, the employer hung a poster. Nobody knew what it said, how long it was up, or who saw it. They held a meeting, but there was no evidence about anybody who attended that meeting. That was the sum and substance of the employer's mitigation efforts.
There's disagreement among the board members about whether we should focus on the employer generally or focus on the specific supervisors who changed positions.
Sure, and I think that derives from the ULP context. In the ULP context, the employer has to specifically disavow the unfair labor practice of the supervisor. So I think you're seeing sort of a carryover into the analysis of objectionable conduct. That notwithstanding, even in this case, you have a specific disavowal from the employee or from the supervisors themselves, and you have a massive, vigorous campaign run by the employer. And again, just to say this, at Appendix Tab 70, I believe it is, there are multiple documents that the employer circulated. It wasn't just a matter of the vote no letter. That was the one that was individually signed and distributed by the charge nurses. But there are multiple other documents that were distributed.
Sorry to prolong this, but do you think if the charge nurses had been silent post-March 5th, 2010, that same result?
Absolutely. Partly because of the fifth prong, or I think it's the fifth factor on the second prong of the Harborside analysis, the lingering effect.
We don't need to say that because we do have the
right. Your lingering effect here is more than just silence. Absolutely.
Yeah. And you also have the margin of victory.
Margin of victory, absolutely. 72-39. So much.
Well, wait. Just on that, that's overstated because if just 15 of the 72 had changed position, then the result's different.
Absolutely, you take 72, right.
So there were 72-39 sounds daunting, but when you say just 15 of 72 had to change position, it doesn't sound so daunting.
I think if you're lobbying for those votes, 15 probably sounds like a lot to you.
Well, but didn't Gilead talk to close to 15?
Sure, but then she also spoke to 30 afterward to say that I've had a complete change of heart, and she distributed a letter to what she thinks was everybody, and there were 100 copies of it. So.
Okay,
unless there's anything else.
Thank you
very much.
May it please the court. My name is Lisa Domenovich, and I represent United Nurses Associations of California, Union of Healthcare Professionals, who's the intervener in this matter. I have just one point I want to make, but before I get to that, I'd like to address some of the questions that have been asked. Judge Randolph, you asked the question about the disjointedness of allowing the union to charge nurse communications, but then saying they can't be entered. Well, the reason that that they were allowed to be offered with the redaction of the charge nurse or the union employees' names is the fact that there is a countervailing interest in protecting the confidential union activities of union employees under Section 7 of the Act, and so. There was a balancing that occurred, and in the balancing, the judge found that the evidence could be given over, but let's be concerned about this interest of the employees. And in the petitioner's reply brief, he says, "Well, the board doesn't point out where this balancing occurred," but in fact, the intervener in our brief, we pointed out that the balancing was in the record at 17 through 19, and also at 39 in the record. So the judge does make a balancing of what's going on, and as you can see, you asked, well, give me an example of something that would have helped, and counsel for a petitioner cited 570 in the record. Well, 570, as you noted, was admitted, but I note that that witness was not subpoenaed or called. So even though many charge nurses were called to testify over the four-day hearing where there were 16 witnesses, the petitioner didn't even bother to then call this witness, Jane Wang, and ask them questions about the document that was admitted. So it's a very tenuous argument to say that this would have had any kind of change in the outcome. And in fact, the steps have not been taken to bear that out. The other argument on the cards, in addition to what counsel for the board has said, I would just point out that, in fact, the requesting that those cards and information about the activities has been found to be that the petitioner committed an unfair labor practice. That's been found by an administrative law judge in October of this year, and that was something that this court could take judicial notice of. As to Judge Kavanaugh's concerns about Silva, I just want to point out Silva was in the ALJ took the evidence in two groups. One is everybody, and then the second group is the exception of Juliet's conduct. And as De Silva, they recognized that she did personally repudiate and also signed the letter. But I think it's important that the board's conclusion that there was not a material effect was based on many findings. It was based on the finding of a vigorous anti-union campaign throughout the election period. There's plenty of support for that in the record. The stipulation of the campaign, the multiple flyers that were circulated by the union or by the employer against
it's
the
hard
union.
To distinguish that from cases like Madison Square Garden, isn't it? If that were all you had.
Exactly. Well, it's hard to say because that's not all we have.
Exactly,
the board has many other factors that it relied on in making its findings.
Seems to me the key one that distinguishes potentially Madison Square Garden and that line of cases is the specific actions of the charge nurses in question. Do you agree with that?
I think that the board did make that finding. The board did not say that that was the only reason or the key reason or anything like that. The ALJ, who was closest to the record, recognized that as a factor.
It's what Member Hayes said, I guess, but not...
Not the everybody.
Board, right.
But I would like to get to... My point, the one point I wanted to say, which is that the board did its job here. There was a four-day hearing. It wasn't even consecutive days. It was May 25th through the 7th, and then again June 7th. There was a lot of time for the petitioner to present evidence. 16 witnesses testified. There's more than a 1,400-page record. And in that, there's a lot of evidence that a vigorous campaign occurred on both sides. The ALJ thoroughly analyzed all of the evidence in the record and drew conclusions that were adopted by a unanimous board. And there's no dispute that Harborside provides a controlling test and that the board applied that test. Instead, what happens in the brief is that the petitioner takes selections from the record of pro-union supervisory conduct to suggest interference. But that doesn't matter because the board's decision said, we'll, for sake of an analysis, we'll be pragmatic, and let's just focus on the second prong because it's very clear that there's no material effect on the outcome of the election. And that's based on several findings. The board found that the conduct of Juliet was isolated, not widespread. It affected at most 10 people, whereas she... And as you noted, Judge Kavanaugh, I mean, there's still 15 votes would have to be different. So those 10 people wouldn't even be enough. But more important than that, there's more. The board found that there was no lingering effect where, as you noted, she personally informed employees that she no longer supported the union on multiple occasions in the weeks preceding the election. And in the very week before the election, personally signed a letter for each individual bargaining unit employee and took steps to deliver that letter. And finally, the board found that the timing of the conduct was not close to the election. In fact, there was a six-week gap between Ms. Juliet's conduct and the election. And so the board, as this court has recognized after a multi-day hearing, the hearing officer is far better situated than the court to draw conclusions about such momentary matters as the emotional climate of the worksite to determine whether there's been fear and coercion that affects the election.
All right, thank you. We appreciate the argument. And Mr. Scott, not only did we burn through your rebuttal, but we gave you 10 extra minutes. On the other hand, we've given both of the others extra time too, so we'll give you another 2 minutes to rebut.
Thank you. A couple of quick points. The focus here is on Juliet. That's what the focus was in the board's decision itself. But I would note that the ALJ decision, in fact, references four different charge nurses who were present and signed cards when other employees were present and were present when those employees signed cards. That's Juliet, Ely, Silva, and Trinidad. So the ALJ also notes that at least nine other charged nurses in addition to Gilead were involved in assisting the union and signing cards. So to understandably, this court has focused on Gilead because Gilead's recantation is the one that was focused on by the board, but we would ask
Silva,
that the
Silva court, recanted too, correct?
Correct. That's correct. She was also signed.
And we're left
that,
with just Ely and Trinidad.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. And with respect to Judge Kavanaugh's point about who was designated as a supervisor in 2008, it's true that Gilead and Ely were not charge nurses at that time. That's why they weren't designated in that stipulation. But they were charge nurses or relief charge nurses in 2010. The union well knew that. And, in fact, if you take a look at
their
organizing document, forgive me, Your Honor.
That's a helpful fact. They were just so I understand what was going on. They were in different positions in 2008?
Correct. They were not in the charge nurse role. And the union knew all these folks were charge nurses in 2010 when they were recruiting them, and that's reflected on the union's own documents showing who's a charge nurse and who's a relief
charge
nurse.
What's your answer to the counsel for the board's point that during the hearing you specifically said to the ALJ, we're not seeking authorization cards?
When Ms. Gamedovich represented that none of those cards had any notation. Initials to show that that charge nurses were that there was nothing on those cards to show a charge nurse was involved, then we did withdraw our request for those cards.
All right, we'll take the case under submission. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.